This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I hope you had an enjoyable Thanksgiving. Thanks for spending part of your Friday with us here in this week in review as we discuss the news of the week with our panel. In the studio here, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And Anthony Chibaterwe.
Greetings.
Filling in for Brent Noctegal, we have a newcomer to our panel, Brent's assistant, Warren Reinch.
Hello.
And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
You know, there's a lot of division in the world today, but on this Thanksgiving edition of Trumpet Hour, we're going to start with a few stories about nations coming together. And what makes these stories interesting is that in each case, they're coming together in accordance with what we would expect based on the Bible's prophecies about what will happen in these nations in the end time. We'll get stories from Asia and the Middle East, but we're going to start in Europe. There's been a lot of talk about Europe building a unified army, some calls by prominent European politicians about forming a new European empire. Well, this week, actual progress was made toward that end in what may seem like a less important aspect of European business, and that is its budget. We had agreement among European nations regarding a budget. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard.
Yes, this story, the most recent chapter, begins exactly a week ago, where France and Germany agreed on new plans for a European budget. They started to get leaked out, I think, to Deutsche Presse Agentur. Then the two leaders, Merkel and Macron, met in Berlin on Sunday, and Macron gave some big speeches, Merkel as well. They talked about a need to refound Europe. And then on Monday, they unveiled their proposals to the meeting of Eurozone finance ministers, the Eurogroup, and they agreed in principle. So what this new agreement does is actually start to take some step forward on something Europe's been trying to do since 2008. At the moment, you've got this Eurozone area where they all use the same currency, the euro, but everyone has different taxation systems, different systems of spending. And so economists for years, even before the founding of the euro, said that can't work. If you're going to have a common currency, you need to have a common government. Otherwise, you know, one nation will be pulling in one direction, another in another direction. They'll be working against each other. It will be impossible for the European Central Bank to set Eurozone policy that's favorable to all the countries when everyone's trying to do all these different things. So this, in a small way, begins to put that into effect. They would have a European budget, and they've talked about as well having some taxes that go directly to the European Union. If they put that in place, that's a huge step on the road to a superstate, giving Europe the authority to collect its own taxes. That's something it's never had before. That's something that has always been something that only a state is allowed to do, a massive test of sovereignty. But they've now got this. France and Germany have agreed. They've not managed to do that since 2008. And they've got the Eurozone agreeing in principle. It looks like to be a small start, where it's a relatively small budget, nowhere near as big as, say, a national budget. They'd just be spending a tiny fraction compared to what national governments spend. But we see this all the time with Europe. We were talking about this in even the European Border and Coast Guard Force. It starts small. They get agreement on it. Afterwards, it's much simpler to ramp it up into a scale that's actually significant.
So you would actually expect that with respect to the budget, this seems like something that a lot of Europeans would have a bit of a tough time with, knowing that their tax dollars are going into some super state budget that where the money could be distributed elsewhere within the European Union, and that there would be a lot of disagreements among Europeans, especially as there does seem to be, say, a rising feeling among a lot of Europeans that they want less, not more, Europe. But you're looking at this as possibly a wedge in the door.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, there are already a lot of big disagreements on it. There are some countries that are unhappy with sending money over. The other big sticking point is Germany has said, well, it's their price. They want nations that get this money to adhere to certain rules, and Spain is already not adhering to those rules. And in a separate piece of news, they've been in trouble this week for not sticking to the Europe's rules. So they're against it because they don't want this condition. So yeah, there's still disagreements, which is why there was an agreement in principle on Monday. These details they're still going to sort out. They're going to meet again in December. But France and Germany want this going by 2021. France and Germany are agreed on this. That's kind of, you know, that's been the big objection in the past. Getting these other nations on board will still be hard, but it's not as big of a deal as getting that agreement. But yeah, absolutely. It's a foot in the door. It's the thin end of the wedge. They can get this in. And then as the economic pressures build, they'll be able to ramp it up and make it more significant.
So you look at the prophecies regarding Europe, and it talks about in Daniel 2 that this is a combination of iron and miry clay, that there's always going to be difficulties in them coming together. But you also look in Revelation, and it talks about all of these kings actually turning their power over to the beast, that there is enough of an agreement that these other nations are combining together into one solid entity that is able to exert a lot of force in the world. And you would expect that they would have to, at some point, they'd have to come to agreement on these types of issues.
Right. And Mr. Armstrong, when you look back at what he wrote, writing about Europe, I mean, he freely acknowledged all of, he never looked at Europe and said they're all going to get along great, they're all going to get along fine, this is going to go smoothly. Never. He was talking about there being a European Union all the way, even used the term European Union, all the way back in 1945. But because of those prophecies that you mentioned, like Daniel 2, that talks about this iron and clay, it doesn't mix, and even just knowing human nature, you know, he never said that they're going to get on smoothly. He always said that it's going to take a lot of pressure to get them together. You look at the Bible, and it talks about the Catholic Church playing a major role in keeping these nations together. And he said, without the Catholic Church, they're never going to be able to unify. That's almost a direct quote. Mm-hmm. He said they've been trying and trying and trying, and they keep failing, and they will keep failing until they get the Catholic Church involved. So, you know, he was fully aware of the difficulties, and the Bible even prophesies that there will be those difficulties. But at the end of the day, those same prophecies that talk about this 10 nations, that talk about some of those difficulties, where Revelation 18 goes on to talk about it being a major economic power, talking about all the merchants of the earth being made rich because of this power. So at the end of the day, yeah, they have these struggles, but they are able to overcome them for a brief amount of time. And it's something that impacts all the way around the earth.
Well, you can look on the website on thetrumpet.com. There's an article, Germany and France Agree on Another Step Toward a European Empire. Go check that out for more information about this. But before we move on, another story here that shows movement on the combined military initiatives of EU leaders. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so, I mean, prophetically, this is the exact same story. We've got something that's a major handover of sovereignty. There are some major obstacles. At the same time, Europe is making progress, though there's still more to do. So in the last couple of weeks, we've heard people talking about a European army, like France President Emmanuel Macron. We need a real European army. Mm-hmm. And you could say, well, people have been talking about the European army since the 1950s. They're still talking about it. What's new? But what we're seeing over the last few years is actual concrete action towards this European army. They've already started taking action. And I think that lends these comments by Emmanuel Macron and others, that makes them give us a lot more reason to really pay attention to what they're saying. So one of the areas that they've made progress in recent years is these various different initiatives where they'll get together and work together on some smaller areas to help all the EU nations and to lay the groundwork for working together in much bigger areas. So they announced 17 new projects where they would work together. That was on November 19th at a meeting of 25 different EU defense ministers and foreign ministers. So one of the big ones from this is a spy school. And this is something that they've been able to move ahead of because of Brexit. Britain has constantly tried to put the brakes on any kind of European intelligence service because they're part of the Five Eyes Alliance with the United States, Australia, and others. With Britain on the way out, they're finally able to move together on this, on intelligence sharing. They're doing other things to have common headquarters, to be able to have their troops move quickly through each other's countries. So just very practical steps. I mean, maybe not say as big and eye-catching as we've announced a grand European army, but very practical steps in that direction. So like I said, I mean, prophetically, this is exactly the same story as we're seeing a European military. These are all components of the European superstate that the Bible says is coming. And we've talked about some of those scriptures like Daniel chapter 2, like Revelation 17, that are just foundational for understanding what the Bible says about this European superpower. And that these are these scriptures that Herbert W. Armstrong used to forecast so accurately what is coming in Europe. This is why in 1945, it's because of these scriptures that he said you're going to see a European Union. And so if you can read his book, Who and What is the Prophetic Beast, that's a great place to start to understand these scriptures, where he goes through and shows exactly why Daniel 2, Revelation 17, and other scriptures refer to modern Europe. So you can get that booklet, and that will just show you, give you the scriptural background behind what we're watching on our news. And we're seeing just headlines on this almost every week now.
We do have an article on this as well that's going up on Monday, A Big Step Forward for Europe's Vision of a Combined Military. 17 projects, defense projects, that the United States of Europe has agreed on. Quite something, and we'll keep our eyes on that as that develops as well. We appreciate that very much, Richard. Over to Asia now, Russia and Japan. They've never resolved some of their differences from World War II, despite repeated efforts to do so. But this looks like it is changing. For this story, we'll go to Anthony Chibatawe.
Russia and Japan are actually the only two countries in the world that haven't officially concluded World War II. That's because of this territorial dispute that both nations have over some very strategically important islands in the North Pacific Ocean. And if you want a mental picture of where these islands are located, just picture the eastern parts of Russia. These islands are located south of the Russian Far East and north of Japan. Before World War II, these islands were Japanese territories. But during World War II, the Allied powers promised to give these islands to the Soviet Union if it joined the war against Japan. And when Japan surrendered, the Russians annexed the islands. So that's the background of the dispute that has been going on for more than 70 years now. And there have been negotiations, compromises, but all have failed. But things are about to change, and change quite dramatically. I like the way a Bloomberg commentary from Tuesday explained this. So I'll read a little bit from it. Quote, "For decades, every sign Russia and Japan had made progress in talks on disputed territories and a post-World War II peace treaty turned out to be a false alarm. This time may be different. Both Russian President Vladimir Putin and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe need a deal more than their predecessors did. Putin and Abe met in Singapore last week and agreed to speed up talks of a peace treaty their two countries negotiated after World War II, but the Soviet Union refused to sign. The talks will be based on a joint declaration the Soviet Union and Japan signed in 1956, since abandoned by both sides, that required the Soviet Union to hand over two islands to Japan once a peace treaty was signed. In recent years, Japan has insisted on the handover of two more islands, and Russia has refused to cede any territory at all," end quote. So what's changing right now? Well, there's quite a lot that's changing. The more tension there is between Russia and Japan, the more likely Japan will strengthen its ties with the United States. And that's obviously something that Russia doesn't want. There are good chances that Japan would would then allow the United States to build military bases on those islands. And Russia wants a deal with Japan to make sure that that never happens. And then the other thing is that Russia is under a lot of sanctions right now. And these sanctions are just forcing the Russians to develop better ties with nations like Japan. And Japan could really help Russia a lot. For one, Russia needs Japan as a customer for its expanding natural gas industry. It's building a lot of pipelines right now. And it cannot really be as successful as it wants if it doesn't have this sort of peace deal with Japan. Another reason is that this Far East region of Russia is really, it's largely underdeveloped, and it could use a lot of Japanese investment. Now, as for Japan, the Bloomberg article suggested that Shinzo Abe is very desperate right now to preserve his power and to polish his legacy in Japan. The growth of the Japanese economy has slowed down a little bit, and even Shinzo Abe's foreign policy hasn't been very popular lately. So this Bloomberg article says that Shinzo Abe is really just trying to save a little bit of face with Japan, and the Japanese would be much more willing to compromise and cede that territory to the Russians. With the Russians, it's a little tricky because a lot of Russians are not too excited about this. In fact, there's a common sentiment in Russia that says how loudly we took Crimea and how quietly we are giving up these islands. And it seems like Putin realizes that many Russians aren't too excited about it, but he also really doesn't care too much anymore right now about his ratings among the Russians. And he does know that in the long term, such a deal will be beneficial to Russia economically and geopolitically. And this will be beneficial for both countries, especially when we think about what's prophesied in the Bible about these two nations. These two nations and many other nations in that region are going to need a very powerful military. And this is just one step towards that union. And Japan will be a part of that union. The Bible does mention the descendants of the Chinese, the Russians, and the Japanese making up this powerful military bloc. It's prophesied in Revelation 16. It's called the Kings of the East. It's also mentioned in Revelation 9 as having an army, a combined army of 200 million men. And we are seeing now these nations getting closer, putting aside their differences and uniting as the Bible told us these nations would.
Yeah, it is quite amazing to see that happening. It seems like every week we have another headline, another story about reconciliation taking place among longtime enemies in the region. We've talked a lot about just how extraordinary it is that Russia and China, the two major powerhouses in the region, are coming together. But you've seen reconciliation taking place. I think it was just last week we were talking between China and Japan. We've talked about the reconciliation that's taking place between China and India. And in every one of these cases, it just goes right along with what we would expect based on that biblical prophecy. It seems like all of the forces at work geopolitically in the world seem to be driving these nations into one another's arms. You see these maybe divisions that have lasted over a period of decades where the leaders are taking the steps to clear out the obstacles and to enable their countries to come together. Quite amazing. And we've seen that, of course, even on the Korean Peninsula.
Even if these nations do not become the best of friends, they are becoming good enough friends to just make that work. So that's that's pretty dramatic.
Well, we do have an article going up on the website, Russia and Japan Accelerate Negotiations to End World War II, on this. And Anthony mentioned Russia and China in Prophecy. That book just gives such a wonderful overview of what prophecy says is going to happen in this region. And again, you get that overview, and then all of these individual headlines make a whole lot of sense. Russia and China in Prophecy, you can find that on thetrumpet.com. We'll put links to these in the show notes for today's program. We appreciate that very much. Anthony, you're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. The Trump administration has reimposed sanctions on Iran for its nuclear activities, but there have been some nations that have blatantly stated they will not comply with those sanctions. They plan to continue doing business with Iran. One notable example is Iraq. To learn about this decision and its implications, we'll turn to Warren Reinsch.
Last weekend, the Iraqi President Barham Saleh went over and discussed these negotiations with the Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, and they talked about enhancing bilateral ties as well as just creating a possible free trade zone in the area, which would allow them to go back and forth trading despite the U.S. sanctions. In doing this, Iraq has basically said, as you mentioned, that they are not going to comply with the U.S. sanctions and that they are going to continue to trade with Iran. These two nations have historically had a very close relationship. Iran has always needed Iraq to be a strong, dominant power on the world scene. They've always needed the food because the Iranian plateau is a pretty dry and arid landscape. So they've always needed Iraq in order to be that strong power. This article by Jerusalem Post just talks about this event. And in it, Raed Nirarat, he was the professor of international relations in the West Bank, he said that Tehran is a key player in Iraq in terms of ideology. And in recent days, the Iraqi-Iranian coziness is obvious, which explains the public shift in rhetoric now. That's just a great word for this relationship between Iraq and Iran. It really sums it up very well, talking about a coziness and how close these two nations have been historically and then how close they are now as well.
Well, yeah, historically, of course, since they've had this reconciliation after Saddam Hussein was eliminated from power. Of course, they were bitter enemies before that, but it was the United States that went in there, removed Saddam Hussein, and that was back in 2003. The Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, was commenting at that time he had been looking at prophecy that suggested there would be a reconciliation between these two countries even before Saddam Hussein was pulled from power. And as soon as that happened, he was right there to say, well, look, this is what prophecy has been saying. The coziness that you're describing really has been quite an extraordinary development, a side effect of that American engagement in Iraq back in 2003, that at that time, I remember Donald Rumsfeld was saying, we're not going to have a Shiite, we're not going to have the mullocracy established in Iraq. And yet here we see it to the point where you now have Iraq openly defying the United States in order to demonstrate this economic solidarity with Iran.
Yeah, in The King of the South, Mr. Fleury had this very interesting comment where he said, it is clear that Iran is working every possible angle in order to extend its influence over the majority Shiite population in Iraq and assume control over its massive oil wealth. Mm-hmm. So as you were saying, it was not very close at that point with Saddam Hussein. Obviously, Iraq and Iran were at war. But since that point, Iran has worked to control Iraq, to gain control of it. They've sent many Shiite militias to fight the Islamic State in Iraq. And we've seen since that point, Iraq has slowly been cozying up to Iran. And at this point, they're such a close relationship. They've had so much trade going on between the two that they kind of need each other in trade. The article mentions that Iraq imports gas from Iran, and as well as a wide range of goods like food, agricultural products, household appliances, air conditioners, auto parts. And the volume of trade last year in 2017 reached $12 billion between these two countries. So that just shows more and more that they've had a really close relationship, and the two nations are growing closer and closer to one another. And then the article concludes with this pretty strong statement as well. It says, it would be viewed as a major geopolitical defeat for the U.S. if Baghdad were to be pulled deeper into the Islamic Republic's orbit. And that's exactly what we are seeing happen.
Well, you know, it'll be interesting to see what the United States does after all of the investment that we've poured into that country since 2003. And with the stance that the Trump administration has been taking so strongly against Iran, one would expect that it would be very uncomfortable with Iraq taking this kind of a stance. In some ways, you can't. It's like an inexorable move toward one another, these two countries. But in another sense, you would expect that the United States would take pretty firm action. We still have troops over there. We still have troops there in Iraq trying to secure that place. And if they're basically saying we are casting our lot in with Iran, I would think that the Trump administration would be would have something to say about that. Nevertheless, I do think this whole story about the way that Iraq has come under Iran's influence is one of the most powerful examples of the power of fulfilled prophecy. Gerald Flory was looking at these the prophecies in Psalm 83 and Daniel 11, and he saw that Iraq and Iran were going to be allied at some point. This was even when they were bitter enemies, and we've seen this happen. And to go back and look at what he wrote in 2003, that we have this article, we'll put this up in the show notes for the program today, Is Iraq About to Fall to Iran, is quite extraordinary. I would encourage everyone to go and look at that article and read that and just see what Gerald Flory was saying now 15 years ago about what's unfolding today between these two countries. We appreciate that very much, Warren. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Recently, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals made a ruling against Donald Trump's administration. And this was contravening a decision that it had made under the Obama administration. Quite a double standard that is being applied here. For this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is just really a very ironic story. Longtime listeners of this program will know that one of the key Bible prophecies we watch is in Isaiah 3, in those first few verses, where it talks about God taking away the mighty man and the man of war, the judge and the prophet and the prudent and the ancient from Israel, or modern-day America. So this is a prophecy about law-abiding judges being taken away. And it's interesting because recently they have had a couple of high-profile law-abiding judges appointed to the Supreme Court. But that doesn't change the fact that throughout the nation, there is still a serious threat to our constitutional order coming from biased judges. And this story you mentioned is probably the most recent powerful example of that, where on November 8th, President Trump, he issued an executive order saying that no illegal immigrant, for the next 90 days, no illegal immigrant can apply for asylum in the United States. If you want to apply for asylum, you have to stay in Mexico, go to an official point of entry, put in your application, and then wait for your answer whether you've gotten asylum or not. It's kind of similar rationale to where he did his so-called Muslim ban last year, where he banned immigrants from seven Middle Eastern nations that have a long history of terrorism. And he's basing that on a ruling in 1952 where Congress delegated to the president. They said, in a case that you deem there's a national security threat, you can ban any group of migrants into the nation for 90 days. This judge has come out and said that, well, you can't, in the Ninth Circuit Court, has come out and struck down that asylum ban, saying, no, immigrants do have the right to illegally cross into the United States and apply for asylum once they're already on the inside. He said because Congress has made that ruling. And the judge is actually correct that Congress has made that ruling, but incorrect in the fact that Congress has still delegated to the president the power to ban any group of immigrants for any reasons up for 90 days if he thinks there's a national security threat. Mm-hmm. That 90 days gives Congress time to debate this. And so that's kind of the legal rationale from here, but it just shows the bias is that now these judges are saying, well, Donald Trump's racist and he's trying to keep Hispanics out of the nations and he can't do that. But the thing is, the last six presidents, including Barack Obama at one point in their administration, have invoked that 1952 congressional law giving the president power to ban certain groups of immigrants mm-hmm. from the nation. And there wasn't a peep from the judges. Mm-hmm. And in the case of the Muslim, I guess the so-called Muslim ban, I mean, the Ninth Circuit struck it down, but then the Supreme Court ruled later in Trump versus Hawaii that he did have the right. And it's almost a sure thing that in this case, once the Supreme Court gets around to it, they'll rule that he does have the right to make this asylum ban. But in the meantime, you've got migrants still crossing illegally into the nation and applying for asylum while they're here. And this shows this double standard that if Barack Obama did it, it was fine. If Donald Trump does it, it's all of a sudden unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. And because it's not and there's this article we're referring from USA Today entitled Biased Federal Judges, Not Trump's Agenda Are the Real Threat to Constitutional Order, showing that this is a major attack on the rule of law, where there's not a consistent law that's applying to all presidents. That, like, if it's a president the judges like, it's fine. Mm-hmm. If the president the judges don't like, you can't do this. And considering there's hundreds of federal judges in the nation, it almost becomes impossible for America to enact border security or foreign policy if Trump needs a unanimous decision by all 700 something judges that right. his decisions are correct.
And the Ninth Circuit essentially said that the Obama administration did this by a kind of executive order, and that was fine. And they're actually upholding what President Obama did by executive order and saying that Donald Trump is not allowed to contravene by executive order what Barack Obama did by executive order. That
right.
makes no sense.
No, that's a little bit of a separate case, and that's not to do with this current asylum ban, but there was another, the DACA, the deferred arrival, mm-hmm. where for the Dreamers, where Barack Obama said by executive order that he said basically anyone who came here illegally as a child can stay. And then President Trump, by executive order, undid that. And then the judges come out and said, it's like, well, that's unconstitutional. And it's like, and then in that case, he's not even using an executive order to overturn a law. He's just using an executive order to overturn a previous executive order by a different president. And so, yeah, that case went down last year. But it is basically the same thing. They're like, if a president we like does it, it's fine. If a president we don't like it, it's not fine. And so you're not getting back to the Isaiah 3 prophecy about taking the judges from the land, judges who are actually willing to uphold the rule of law. This has nothing to do with the rule of law. This is a very naked political partisanship.
Which is quite amazing, this Twitter feud that has been going back and forth between Donald Trump and Chief Justice John Roberts, where Donald Trump said something about we have to, you know, do something about these Obama judges. John Roberts says there are no Obama judges. Everybody's impartial. We're all just trying to do the best job that we can. That seems like a statement of just absolutely extraordinary naivety.
Because that is the ideal. I mean, that's what the judiciary was set up to be, is an impartial group of judges that would uphold the rule of law. And so that's what John Roberts is saying. He's like, said, ideally, you'd have this, but he should know that that's not the case. I mean, as a matter of fact, when in regards to the, I guess, the so-called Muslim ban, where the Ninth Circuit Court said that Donald Trump doesn't have the right to do this. The Supreme Court overturned that as an unconstitutional decision, and John Roberts was one of those who voted that it was an unconstitutional decision. And so by the same rationale, if this current asylum ban goes to the Supreme Court, I fully expect John Roberts will probably be one of the ones who votes that it's unconstitutional. So it's it is really strange that he's getting up there saying, well, there are no Obama judges, because it's he knows what this judge does is unconstitutional, and in all likelihood will vote that it's unconstitutional. But to come out there and just say, like, hey, there are no Obama, we're all on the same team. I mean, he's trying to, you know, like, seem like he's rising above the political fray, but that's not the reality.
He's diving into the middle of the political fray by making a statement like that, really. I just find it amazing to think, well, what the way that it's viewed, basically, that the conservatives have a 5-4 majority on the court right now, and then John Roberts makes a statement like this that makes you wonder whether that 5-4 majority is actually a 5-4 majority.
Right, because now that Anthony Kennedy's retired and replaced, just looking at the ideological spectrum of the judges on the Supreme Court, John Roberts is the new swing vote, in that he's
the
most
Anthony Kennedy.
He's the most liberal of the conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
And so it will likely be up to him whether this asylum ban holds or not.
Yeah, I wonder if he feels a certain responsibility to maintain the ideological balance on the court by swinging further to the left. I guess we will see. Well, we appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We're going to take a short break. Coming up, we'll get a follow-up to the Brexit question and Theresa May's job security. We'll talk about a threat from Iran against American forces in the Middle East. We'll look at a Japanese military base in Africa and discuss a rise in murders in London. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Well, last week in our Week in Review recording, we were on a minute-by-minute Theresa May unemployment watch. Here a week later, the British Prime Minister still has her job. What is the latest in the contention over the deal that she put forward regarding Brexit? For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Theresa May is still here. That's what I signed off with last week. It's still the case this week. It looks like the plot within the Conservative Party to get rid of her as the Conservative Party leader and hence push her out as Prime Minister failed. Not enough Conservative members got behind that for there to be a no confidence vote in her leadership. In the following week, she's basically doubled down on the deal that she wants to make this happen. She's kind of tried to sell it as this is a good deal for Britain. If anything, I'd say the opposition to the deal has hardened. And so now the big moment to watch in terms of this deal progressing is when it comes to a vote in Parliament. Is there going to be a majority in Parliament to approve this deal? That's a really interesting question. And it's a parliamentary situation that really you have to go back to, I think, the 1830s and the Corn Laws before you get some kind of parallel, where you've got a Conservative Prime Minister. A good chunk of the Conservatives have said they will not vote for the deal. She's being supported by the Democratic Unionist Party. They have said they will not vote for the deal and that they may continue to oppose Conservative legislation from here on out if they push forward with it. But there are members of the Labour Party that might support the deal. And so it seems like Theresa May is going to have to try and get kind of cobbled together support from Conservative Remainers and members of the Labour Party if she's going to get this through. So it'll be very messy if she manages it. There's a good chance that she won't manage it. It looks like you could even have, I mean, there's still the potential for bringing down the government, for political turmoil that just echoes on for months. There's still the potential for that somehow you could get Jeremy Corbyn become Prime Minister out of this, and you know that will be we'll have a communist, the Soviet Socialist Republic of the United Kingdom after that, and it will be an absolute disaster. So there's a lot of uncertainty. a lot of mess. Now, there are a lot of people that still oppose the deal, and they're thinking they might be trying to keep that they're not trying to get rid of Theresa May because they're trying to keep their powder dry to potentially make their mark once this deal fails in Parliament. But as you can see, just a lot of mess and a lot of politicking behind the scenes and scheming and still uncertainty and no prospect of clarity really for several weeks.
So you wrote about this in your Trumpet brief earlier this week. Would you mind just summarizing the substance of the opposition to this deal? Why conservatives are so upset at what Theresa May has put on the table here?
Sure. So at the moment, we're in this European Union where a huge percentage of our laws are made in Brussels without, and we have very little we can do to influence that. What Theresa May's deal does to fix that is to put us in a situation where many of our laws are made in Brussels and there's absolutely nothing we can do to fix that. It's not, and a lot of more and more people are saying, well, this is not really an improvement at all on our current situation. We voted for Brexit to take back control, to be in charge of our own laws, our own government policy. And what this does is actually give us less control over our own laws and our own government policy. It basically, there's a 600-page document that covers all of these different these different aspects of it. It tries to hold Northern Ireland hostage and basically says, well, if Britain, if you do want to try and split away and make your own laws, Northern Ireland is still going to be stuck under the European Union's laws. No prime minister could ever agree with that because that would really begin the division and the splitting up of the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. So that it does a lot to keep Britain in this relationship. And then the referee of this whole deal will be the European Court of Justice. And the European Court of Justice basically takes even the most bizarre and tiniest of excuse that nobody had even thought of to expand the European Union's powers. And it basically just exists to support and cheerlead for the European Union. Mm-hmm. So you're just locked in this position with no real prospect of exit, where Britain just has to follow Europe's laws, pass its own equivalent to Europe's laws. It doesn't do what people who voted for Brexit wanted to come out of this.
So the point that you make in this is Trumpet brief is essentially we're getting a look at the authoritarian nature, the undemocratic nature of the European Union in the way that it's handling this, and it's putting Britain in a spot that it absolutely has no good option in recovering from.
Right. They're certainly doing all they can to they're using all the power that they can to attack, to persecute Britain. And yeah, it shows that imperial nature of the European Union. They don't have a common army yet. They don't have a common budget yet, like we talked about at the first half. Mm-hmm. But those areas where they can act aggressively, they absolutely are. And that gives us an idea, a picture of how Europe will act once they do have that European army, once they do have that financial muscle that maybe they don't have right now. So this gives us, which is why one of the points I made in this article is this is why this whole debate is much more important than just the UK. This shows the whole world how Europe acts when it does have some power. And maybe Britain, I think that there might be a chance that Britain is successfully able to fight back against this. I'd like to hope that as a British person. Mm-hmm. But it still shows us this is what the European Union does when it can do things like this, when it is able to throw its weight around.
Well, we do appreciate that, Richard. Go check out his article, An Imperial EU Wants to Squash Britain. It puts this in the prophetic context, helps you understand just what's going on here and how it will end, and points back to those statements Herbert W. Armstrong made back when Britain joined this European Union in 1973. We can't draw enough attention to those statements that Herbert Armstrong made at that time, just saying how this was going to create an endless amount of problems for Britain when it signed up for this deal. And we're seeing that play out in quite a dramatic fashion now before us. We appreciate that. Richard, tensions between the United States and Iran aren't cooling off at all. On Wednesday, a top Iranian general made a very provocative statement regarding the vulnerability of America's forces in the Middle East to attack from Iran. For this story, we'll go back to Warren Reinsch.
We have covered this subject quite a bit in the past, actually, and we've been following this trend of Iran continually working on its ballistic missile program under the Joint Comprehensible Plan of Action that didn't remove their ability to work on their ballistic missiles. And they've been continually improving those. This article just talks about, a next step in that progress. Amir Ali Hajizadeh, the head of the Air Division of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, said that now Iran's missile arsenal has the ability to strike U.S. bases in Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and Afghanistan. And this is a huge development because now they're being more bold. The Iranian government has already stated that it's threatened to shut down the Strait of Hormuz because of the sanctions going on against Iran. And they even mentioned that they have the ability to strike U.S. aircraft carriers stationed in the Persian Gulf. So this is a pretty large development because Iran is growing more bold, and they're also just showing that they're kind of fed up with having sanctions against them, and they're ready to go to the next step, if you will. They're starting to threaten America instead of just sit back and do nothing in that regard.
You look at Daniel's prophecy. It says that the king of the south will push against the king of the north, and we've drawn a lot of attention to that word push. This really is a reflection of Iran's foreign policy. It's very pushy. And these kinds of statements against the United States, not unusual, but quite provocative.
Because of that continued development with their ballistic missile system, this general said that their missiles are now able to strike accurately within 30 meters at a distance of over 500 kilometers away. So they have a very large range, and a lot of the American troops and American bases are in that range. And they're just working to continually push their control and become more bold and exert their power to control the sea gates. And that's something that we've always been looking for in prophecy. And that's Iran's control of the sea gates. They're starting to use their ballistic missile systems, especially the Fatah 110 missile was designed in a way to shoot these ships that are flowing through the sea gates. And that's just exactly how Iran is going to push at Europe. They're going to gain control of these sea gates, and then they're going to shut them down, or at least attempt to shut them down, and that's going to cause Europe to come against them because they rely so heavily on the oil that flows through those trade routes.
Hmm. Well, that is quite a story. We appreciate that very much, Warren. We're going to have to move on. We're running out of time here, but we'll go back to Asia now. An announcement from Japan regarding a military base in Africa. For this, we'll go back to Anthony Chibadewe.
Yeah, here on the program, we've talked quite a lot about China's military base in Djibouti, but we haven't talked as much about Japan's military base in Djibouti. Well, now is the time to talk about it. For reasons related to what we talked about a little earlier, the base was opened in 2011 to accommodate Japan's forces working under the UN's in anti-piracy operations. And Japan is a major economic power, and it really is important for Japan to secure all these maritime trade routes and eliminate piracy. But during that time that Japan was involved in these operations, piracy in the region has declined significantly, almost to zero, actually. And so it's mission accomplished, right? Well, not quite. Japan is not planning to pack up and head home. In fact, on November 15th, we heard that Japan plans to keep that military base open. And some reasons that have been given to justify that is that piracy still occurs. And it's true, it still does occur, but a lot of people and a lot of analysts believe that the main reason Japan wants to remain in Djibouti is to counteract China. Because China, as we said, already has a base there in Djibouti. It was officially opened last year. And not long after that, Japan actually expanded that base from 12 hectares to 15 hectares. The Japanese government said that it wants to maintain a ratio of one Japanese soldier for every 10 Chinese soldiers in Djibouti. So we are seeing more of a reaction to China expanding its military, and Japan is responding similarly, despite the fact that its constitution prohibits development of a military for offensive intervention purposes. Mm-hmm. We have been tracking this development of Japan slowly moving away from that, and we're seeing it happening, and all these so-called needs, these military needs, are forcing Japan to justify the expansion of its military. Now, it might be easy for some people to say, well, China is in Djibouti, why shouldn't Japan be in Djibouti? Well, like we said, Japan had this constitution that prohibited it from doing that because of the atrocities it committed in World War II. And back in 1971, we were talking about Japan eventually building up its military because of Bible prophecy. Herbert W. Armstrong wrote, "Japan today has no military establishment, but we should not lose sight of the fact that Japan has become so powerful economically that it could build a military force of very great power very rapidly." Mm-hmm. And again, this is all because of Bible prophecy. Bible prophecy indicates that Japan will be part of this powerful Asian combine of nations. And we are seeing right now justification for just expanding that military.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting considering Japan's history, how it has used this this offensive type of arrangement in Djibouti. And now that the you make a good point, the piracy has dropped off and they're not using that as a mission accomplished. It's time to head home. They're going to keep pressing what they have accomplished there. We'll keep our eyes on that. And do check out our trend article, Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Toward Militarism, why we keep such a close eye on these types of moves by Japan. We'll put a link to that in the show notes under this this item. We appreciate that, Anthony. One last story, an increase in the number of murders in London. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
London's murder rate is set to hit a 10-year high. 121 people or more have already been murdered in London, and if the rate continues, they'll hit 140 murders by the end of the year. Most of this is being motivated by a rise in knife crime. According to the Home Secretary, much of this murder rise may also be motivated by police officers fearing to do their job for fear of being called racist. The Home Secretary said that it doesn't matter if someone's black or brown or white or whatever they are, and then went on to say that it's like we still need to be willing to confront and disarm those who are acting aggressively or suspiciously. And so he stopped just sort of inferring that the reason this murder rates are going so high is the police are reluctant to confront racial minorities, and especially London's huge Muslim community. It's very significant from a Bible prophecy standpoint, as there's a prophecy in Hosea 5, verse 13, that talks about when Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, then Ephraim went to Assyria and sent King Jerob, yet he could not heal you. And longtime listeners of this program will know that Ephraim is Britain and Assyria is Germany. And so this is a prophecy about Britain realizing it's sick and going to Germany for help. And so these rising murder rates are a symptom of that sickness, that moral sickness that's taking root in Britain. And the fact that these murder rates are going up and up and up as knife crimes get more and more prevalent just shows how close they are to the ultimate fulfillment of that prophecy.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of all of these stories of these minority communities, immigrant communities within Britain that have committed terrible atrocities, you know, grooming young girls for gang rapes, that type of thing, where you just don't, there's so much of it that's taking place where the media won't touch it, the police won't really do anything about it. The way that you are showing how much there's a link between the rising murder rate and the same kind of issue is quite interesting. And it really does show considerable sickness in Ephraim. We appreciate that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed on today's program. You can email us your thoughts to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibatterwe, Warren Reinch, and Richard Palmer.
It's my pleasure.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
It's been fun.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Gino Chi. And I'll leave you with the words of Tony Robbins. So much of what makes us wealthy is free. The secret to wealth is gratitude. It's not just what we achieve or accomplish. It's what we appreciate. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.